This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Mark Maron, is not only a very funny comic, his podcast, WTF, is the go-to place for interviews with comics. A lot of great comics have been in his garage where he records his podcast. Maron spoke with Terry last Monday. He has a new memoir called Attempting Normal, in which he says he wishes his imagination was fueled by something other than panic and dread. Maron's anxiety is a frequent topic of his new TV series as well. It's called Maron and just began on IFC. He plays a character based on himself named Mark Maron. Here's how the first episode opens.
Things are going pretty well for me right now, but that's a problem because when things are going well, that means there's a voice in my head saying, you're going to screw it up. You're going to screw it up, Mark, just over and over again. I just wish that voice were louder than the voice screaming, let's screw it up! A few years ago, I was planning on killing myself in my garage, and now I'm doing the best thing I've ever done in my life in that same garage. It's a podcast. You know what a podcast is? I've been on Conan O'Brien like 47 times, and you don't know who I am, right?
That's Mark Maron from the start of his new IFC TV series. Maron, welcome to Fresh Air, Mark Maron. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I love that opening because it sounds like, you know, as I was watching it for the first time, I thought, oh, I guess he's being interviewed by a reporter who's not on screen. And then we realize, no, you're just trying to impress the veterinarian who's treating your cat and you're thinking about how you're going to hit on her afterwards.
Yes.
So I love it how at the same time you're trying to impress her and then you're almost accusing her of not knowing who you are.
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, it's a tricky thing to be charming and completely insecure at the same time.
So I don't usually start interviews with questions about suicide attempts, but since you bring it up in the very, very start of your show, you say you once tried to kill yourself in the garage that you are now using for your podcasts. So since you brought it up,
yeah,
why did you try to kill yourself?
Well, I think I should be clear that I didn't try to kill myself. The deal was is that I thought about it a lot. You know, it was a difficult point in my life. My career had sort of hit a wall. I was in the middle of a horrible divorce. You know, I wasn't getting much stand-up work, and I really didn't know what to do. And when you invest half of your life into this, into a creative field, into a dream like being a stand-up, when you all of a sudden, when you're in your late 40s or mid-40s and everything goes wrong, there's no plan B in place anymore. You know, you have that moment where you're like, all right, well, I could always, and there's just nothing there. And in my mind, because of pride and being brokenhearted, I just would, you know, fantasize about killing myself. I didn't see any other way out in my brain. I don't know that I really wanted to, but I found it relaxing to know that I could if necessary. And that's where I was at that point when I started the podcast.
As you mentioned, you've been on Conan more than 45 times. Are you ever, were you ever like the emergency guest, the replacement for someone who's canceled at the last minute?
Always, yeah. That was what would happen a lot of times is that because I had a very active mind and I was always moving through stuff, they knew that there was a real good chance I could do a panel segment, that I could sit down and talk to him, and we had a rapport. So I would get that call a lot. I, you know, between me and you and everyone who was listening, I just got that email about a week ago again, you know, now, you know, here on the new show, that moment where it's you're sort of like, what are you doing tomorrow? Can you? And yeah, I used to get that all the time. It made it very exciting.
So you have a really terrific WTF podcast with Conan. And you write about that podcast in your memoir. So you write that you were really uncomfortable about Conan coming over to your garage. You'd been on his show a lot of times. You really admired him. Why were you so uncomfortable about him coming over to the garage to do the podcast?
Well, there's still a thing about, you know, he's a TV star. And, you know, I always looked at him as the guy who would let me on his show. And we had this rapport. And it was just really the fact that even though I'd done his show so many times over so many years, that I don't know his life. I don't know him. It's really that weird separation between, you know, what we get as fans or as coworkers of somebody who has a public personality and what you really know about him. So when he was coming over, I was sort of overwhelmed and grateful that he was going to come, but there was a lot of insecurity in it. It's like, now he's going to see my house. He's probably going to use my bathroom. He's going to judge my couch. You know, there was a lot of things going through my mind. Like, this is an important man who had me on his show so many times, and now he's going to see, you know, how I live. And there was a lot of insecurity around that. And also, how do I talk to Conan? I've never seen him out of a suit. You know, I mean... This is a guy that throughout, you know, a good chunk of my career would just say hi in the dressing room and then go do his show, and I'd come out and do it. So it was the casualness that was intimidating to me, you know.
So I'm going to ask you to do a short reading about what the interview was like and what it was like afterwards. So this is Marc Maron reading from his new book, Attempting Normal, about his interview with Conan O'Brien in Maron's garage for his WTF podcast.
Once we got behind the mics, it all flowed very easily. It wasn't about what was said. It was the fact that this was the first time I had really talked to him. He told me stuff that wasn't part of his public narrative, and I got to know him a bit. It was emotional for me because I had always wanted to be his pal in some way, and even more so because he was doing the podcast, and that meant I was doing something relevant. I felt proud. I wanted to do a good job because I respected him, and in some way, it was a turning of the tables. When we finished, we went back into the house and Conan was just sort of lingering. He was looking at my stuff on my table, on my walls, and it was awkward again. Not in a bad way, but we were both back to our roles. I was a guy whom he let appear on his show and had a good television rapport with, and he was a star who, in my mind, had better things to do. That might not have been the case. We have a history, and we had just had this great talk, and now I knew I couldn't say, okay, we'll talk tomorrow, or let me know when you want me to come by the house for dinner, or anything real friends say to each other. It literally got to the point where I was wondering how to get him out of my house because I didn't know what to do or say. It was time for him to go back to his life and me to get on with mine.
I love that part because I really relate to that feeling that after you've had this like really personal conversation and then the mics get turned off, you sometimes have like no idea what to say. And it's such a contrast because, you know, you could be so personal and intimate in the interview and in real life, it's so awkward.
Yeah, it can be. And I don't really know how to deal with it sometimes. I've had people linger, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's that moment where you realize, right, we don't know each other's lives. We're not really part of each other's lives. And because of what we're doing for this show, you know, we've just really connected in a deep way. And I'm very sensitive to that. I mean, I've had experiences with people in my life that literally lasted maybe 5 minutes and had such a lasting impression on me that I feel bonded to those people. I think that's a lot of what, you know, propels some of the interviews on my show. But, you know, John Hamm hung out after he did my show and sat on the deck with me and my girlfriend. And, you know, it gets to the point where it's like, okay. And you don't even know if you can say, like, all right, I'll call you. We'll do the thing. It's not there. And who else? Like, you know, when I interviewed Jonathan Winters at his home before he passed away, you know, he wanted to go out to lunch. And it was an honor, but there's just a moment where you're like, is this happening? Is this my life? Is this okay? I mean, is he comfortable? He must be. He asked me to go with him. It's very tricky.
Yeah. So I thought now we can hear an excerpt of the podcast you did with Conan O'Brien. And in this part, you've been talking about how difficult it was for Conan when he first started hosting Late Night back in the 90s, because he'd never done that kind of work before. People weren't used to seeing him on camera. He wasn't used to being on camera. He was getting bad reviews. There was a lot of public criticism. So here's him talking a little bit about that period.
I probably have a Catholic need to suffer. That helps me. So the trials and tribulations that I went through in 93, 94 probably was my way of paying whatever dues I felt I needed to pay to keep that show. And then once I had suffered enough, there was part of me that was like, all right. And now I could move on to another level. And that's probably what happened.
So that really did have that, Catholicism has that kind of effect. Like, because I have no familiarity with it. But the idea of suffering that's part of life is really something that's plowed into your brain.
Yeah, it gets into your DNA. And I'm really trying very hard in the last couple of years.
Like, you're not doing it right if you're not suffering?
Yeah, I'm trying to and you know what? My escape from that was always comedy. Comedy was always something that I could get into a zone, and you can have a really good time, and people can really be laughing, and I would think later on, wait a minute, people liked that, and I was enjoying myself. And I was in the moment, and I wasn't self-conscious, so comedy was always my escape valve. And then the tricky thing was I turned it into a career, and when you turn the thing you love into a career, you're playing with fire.
That was Conan O'Brien talking to Mark Maron for Mark Maron's WTF podcast. So, Mark Maron, do you relate to that? Those are some nice insights there from Conan, but do you relate to the idea of suffering being an inspiration?
I relate more to the fact that, you know, comedy is a relief and comedy is a release and comedy is the only way that we can feel present and lose ourselves. I find over time that I don't enjoy suffering, and there's something, you know, comforting and sort of predictable about the way your brain works around your own troubles. But I have found that I'm more of an anxiety-ridden person, that I experience a tremendous amount of dread and fear and panic. I think I've been mischaracterized a bit as a guy that sort of gets off on his own misery. I think that misery for people that are incredibly anxious or frightened is something consistent. I think obsession sometimes works as almost a spirituality. You know, you have a routine that your brain kind of loops around that you call home, but that's usually in defense of some other part of you that's unruly. And for me, I think it's anxiety and panic and worry and dread.
Do you find that's true of most comics, that they have either depression, anxiety, dread, suffering that they have to escape from, and that comedy becomes the escape valve? And they found a way to talk about horrible things in a funny way, but it doesn't make the horrible things any less horrible necessarily?
I don't know. The reason it's hard for me to speak for comics in general, and certainly I've spoken to a lot of them, and certainly I initially thought that we all had to be miserable to be great comics. But as time goes on, I don't know that that's really the case. And what I found when I was a kid that really, you know, made me gravitate towards comedy was they seemed to have an angle on things. I think that comedy, when you're capable of it, it has a lot of uses. You know, you can sort of disarm a situation. You can also, you know, attack with a certain amount of clarity and finesse that may not be dangerous. You can protect yourself. You can, you know, ease pain in others. I mean, it's a very, you know, multifaceted tool and creative thing. So I don't know that it necessarily serves the same purpose for all comics, but I do know that for me, when watching comedy, and also the way I do comedy, is it puts an angle on things. You can get a handle on things in a very precise way, and it disarms a lot of that dread and panic.
So I want to ask you about another podcast that you did, and you talk about this one in your new book. So you used to be really good friends with Louis C.K., the comic, who now has a TV show called Louis. You have a really terrific interview with him, and in this interview, part of it was about your relationship and how it kind of fell apart, partially because you had gotten so resentful of his success. At least that's how I understood it from listening to the podcast. And I just want to play an excerpt in which you're talking to each other about the friendship. So Louis C.K. speaks first.
You don't have to put this in the podcast if you don't want to, but what I would say, as far as trying to stay friends with somebody that you have a hard time thinking about what they're doing against what you're doing,
yeah,
is focus on them needing a friend.
Yeah.
It takes a good friend to stay with you in hard times.
Yeah.
It takes a good friend to stay with you in good times. Everybody needs support. Yeah. Everybody does.
Yeah.
So you're letting me down. If you see me doing something and you have a hard time coming to terms with it because you're feeling about your own life, what's really happening is you're letting me down as a friend by being jealous.
Okay.
So think about the other person. Well, think about what they might need.
But in my heart,
I could have used you. I got divorced. I got a show canceled. You know, I had some tough times. I could have used a friend.
But you didn't.
Those times that were making you jealous, I was struggling. I was having a hard time.
But
doing the Louis show was really hard. Trying to keep my family together was hard.
But the thing is that in the way our friendship always operated, it was not that I was kept up to date in the day-to-day things. It wasn't a day-to-day call that we had. But it seemed that most of the time, the thing that made our friendship so deep and so strong was that when we did talk, we made each other feel better.
No, it's true. But you shut me out. You shut me out because you were having a hard time.
Okay. And, well, I apologize again.
Well, I apologize to you because I did it to you probably out of resentment. Ignored your emails because you ignored my phone calls back when there was no email.
Can we get back on track or what?
Yeah, I think we can.
Well, that's really an amazing piece of tape.
It's choking me up now. I mean, it's like, some of these podcasts I did, that was a while ago, you know, and there's an emotional intensity to that thing that's...
It's real. Heavy, it just sounds absolutely real. And
it was real. I don't listen to these things after I do them. And just hearing that, I'm like, oh my God, it was so loaded and intense. Well, that happened.
So sometime after that podcast, he wrote a role for you in an episode of his TV series, Louie, which is based on his life. But in this episode, it's about the rift in your relationship. And in this episode, Louie has blamed you for the friendship falling apart. But he has this revelation that it was actually his fault. It wasn't your fault. It was his fault. So he goes over to your house to apologize. And I want to play the scene. He comes over to your house. He walks inside. And here's the conversation.
I realized that it was my fault completely. And it's like I was a total asshole to you, and I stopped being your friend. And I'm shocked now when I think of it, that I would ever have thought it was anything that you did. You did nothing. And I know that now, and I don't know how to look back at, you know, you look back at your actions and... Man, I don't know if this has any meaning or worth to you, and I don't. Maybe this is just more of me being selfish, but I just want to say, Mark, that I'm sorry, and I wish that I don't know what else to say.
Uh huh. Okay, is that it, or?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, well, I appreciate that, but I guess you don't remember, but you came over here 5 years ago and said the exact same thing.
I did?
Yeah, I mean, you cried that time. You didn't cry this time, so I guess that's something.
I kind of remember that now.
Yeah. Well, I accepted that time. I don't know this time, whatever. I don't know what you need something from me. Do you want...
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, again? All right.
Okay, I'm the...
Okay. We good then?
Yeah, man, I'm right. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's all right. I mean, you know, You know.
All right. Well, I really am sorry, though, just so you know.
Okay. I get it. It's okay. You know what would be really great, though? If maybe you call me up, you ask me for coffee, we go out to dinner, something like that.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Or we could just do this again in 5 years.
Okay, man.
It's all right.
Okay.
How you been? Good, man. That's very nice for you to ask.
Okay?
All right,
yeah.
All right.
That is so great. And I think just like hearing the actual conversation you had on your podcast and then hearing a similar story transformed into Louie's TV show, it's just a fascinating comparison. And what also I find so interesting is that Louis C.K. makes it all his fault in this. It's like...
Yeah, and
it's not only his fault. He's so kind of careless about the relationship. He doesn't even remember he apologized to you 5 years ago.
Yeah, and that's very Louie. I think he was being pretty honest in that exchange. And I think even listening to it again, because I watched it once and I remember doing it with him. And but I think there was a lot of genuine emotion there. I think that on some part of him was a genuine apology. For what might have been his side of the selfishness in our relationship. I'm going to look at it that way because I feel that because he was definitely just listening. And as you know, when you just listen and you don't have any visuals, there's an emotional depth to it that I don't think I really heard until I just listened to that now when you played it.
So when I heard it, I was thinking, okay, so Louis C.K. is the main character in this, and he's given the blame to himself because it's going to make it a more interesting episode, and because he's a generous guy, and so he's going to blame himself in his show and not blame you. But you think he's actually taken some of the blame for real in this?
Well, I think that these things are two-sided, and I think that when you listen to my podcast, that I could have pointed fingers, I could have been petty, And in that moment where, you know, I take responsibility for my side of it, I could have said, but you this, but you that, but you, and I realized like this was, that's not the time for it. You know, understand and take the consequences of your actions. So I think there's a chance you would have to ask Louis if there was some part of him that was, you know, taking some responsibility, or maybe he was just, you know, created this role and did his riff on our riff and made it his own in that way. I don't really know. You'd have to ask him. But I do know that we are getting along better.
Good. I'm so glad to hear that. So you've mentioned that you think in one of your podcasts, as I recall, you mentioned that you think a lot of comics have issues about their fathers. And so in your book, you're right, I am at a crossroad. I'm in a relationship with a woman who's 20 years younger than I am. We're living together and she wants a baby. And you are afraid of becoming a father. What are your fears?
It's interesting. I never really thought about it too much, which I think is because of the way I was brought up and being very, you know, sort of self-involved. You know, my brother, on the other hand, he has three kids and he did it with a vengeance. He's like, I'm going to have a lot and I'm going to do it differently. I'm a very panicky guy and I worry a lot. And it's that's where my brain goes. There's a dread thing that I have to fight on a daily basis, you know, so when I think about, like, you know, having a baby, like, I go right from, like, yay, a baby, to, like, oh, my God, it's not breathing. You know, there's nothing in between those things, you know. So, you know, I got to get past that. And I know, you know, that I don't, you know, I know I'm older now, and there's a fear of that as well. You know, am I too old? Do I want to do that to a kid? I mean, quite honestly, I remember the first kid I met with old dad. And, it, you know, and it was awkward. It was weird. It was mind-blowing. You know, you're in first grade and you're waiting for your parents to come pick you up. And his dad comes and you're like, who's that? And the kid's like, that's my dad. You're like, how old is he? I don't even know. You know, like, does he do anything? Yeah, sometimes. I got to go. I got to help him. You know, they're... You know, and I know there's a lot of old dads around. I know there's a lot of, you know, baby boomers who realize that, you know, whatever narcissistic trajectory they were on sort of crapped out on them, and they have no meaning, and they have kids at 50 or 60, or they're doing second families. It's just, at this point, you know, I'm warming up to it, and I want to do it, and I want to trust the situation, because apparently it's something that people do. They seem to be able to handle it. And from what I understand, there's an amazing thing that happens there, right? And I think I feel like we're going to do it, but I'm incredibly consumed with anxiety and nervousness about it. And a lot of people are like, just do it. And it's like, you don't understand who I am. You know, I'm already freaking out.
Well, Mark Maron, it's really been great talking with you. Thank you so much. I wish you good luck with the book and the new TV series.
Thank you so much, Terry. It was an honor and a thrill to talk to you again.
Oh, how nice of you to say that. Thank you so much.
Mark Maron spoke with Terry Gross last Monday. His new memoir is called Attempting Normal. His new TV series, Maron, has just begun on IFC. It's based on Maron's life, but it's fictional.
Look, folks, I'm not an alpha male, all right? I act like one sometimes, but I know I'm not a real one. And the way I know that is if I ever lock eyes with a real alpha male, they know. They're like, say hi to the little girl in there. And I'm like, oh, no, they saw you.
Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review of Shirley Clarke's 1967 film Portrait of Jason, which he says fiercely holds our attention because of the issues it raises about what's real and what isn't. The film has been newly restored and is currently playing in New York.
If reality TV has a redeeming value, it's that it teaches you to be suspicious of claims that you're seeing real people doing real things. This is valuable in an age when memoirs bristle with made-up events, and everyone from the Kardashians to the Obamas orchestrate their media coverage. These days, it's hard to tell whether an article, book, or TV show is showing you the real person or only a performance. The same uncertainty lies at the heart of Shirley Clarke's Portrait of Jason, an extraordinary 1967 nonfiction film just released in a fabulous restored version from Milestone Films. Shot over 12 hours in Clark's apartment at New York's Chelsea Hotel, the film could hardly sound simpler. It's basically one man with a drink in his hand who talks about his life into the camera. Yet this man is anything but ordinary. He's a loquacious 33-year-old gay black hustler who dreams of having a nightclub act. And from the beginning, he could hardly be more complex or elusive. He starts the movie by saying his name is Jason Holliday, which sounds rather upbeat. But we quickly learn that's not his real name. He was born Aaron Payne. And for the next 105 minutes, Jason tells you his story. About growing up in Trenton, where being gay was not cool. About working as a houseboy for folks who blithely called him a spook to his face. About orgies and hustling and being locked up. Along the way, Jason does impressions of Mae West and Katharine Hepburn, sings a number from Funny Girl, and tells a hilarious story about Miles Davis. But as the hours pass and he drinks more and more, Jason starts to melt down behind his handcuff-shaped glasses. Yet whether Jason's laughing or crying, he holds you rapt with tales that conceal as much as they reveal. Here, he talks about the father who beat him.
My father is the character of my family. He really is. His name, Brother Tough. When I was a little kid, people used to pass by the house and say, "Hey, Fanny, is old Tough home?" I have a brother who was a groovy, nice, quiet cat. And my father's got muscles bulging for days, and he's a bad operator, you know, big-time gambler, bootlegger. And I'm out in the street skipping rope. Tough, don't dig this. Too tough. What can he do? I'm his.
While Jason's race and sexuality made him a born outsider, Shirley Clark was a self-made one. The daughter of wealthy New York parents, she began as a dancer, but moved to nonfiction film. There was always something radical in Clark waiting to be released, and she found it in African-American culture, taking a black lover, Carl Lee, and making groundbreaking films about junkies and gangs and jazz musicians. These subjects reflected her own estrangement from an American mainstream that wasn't interested in them or her. In that sense, Portrait of Jason is a portrait of Shirley seen through the looking glass. Clark knew she had a mesmerizing subject in Jason, whose stories are punctuated by a laugh whose mercurial meaning, from delight to pain to impacted fury, could keep a psychology class busy for a semester. Still, she and her colleagues keep goading him to give more, to bare himself more deeply, until he eventually breaks down, offering us the naked truth of his soul. If, that is, you believe we all have a single, secret, unified self hidden by myriad social masks. But is the drunken, weeping Jason really a more authentic Jason than the laughing storyteller? Many people think so. It's not for nothing that John Cassavetes admired the film. Yet if Clark and company truly did tear off Jason's self-protective armor just to make a movie, its detractors aren't wrong to call the process queasy-making and sadistic. Documentary is nearly always exploitative, and this would be the avant-garde version of newsmen pushing cameras into the faces of grieving parents just to capture their tears. Then again, it's not clear that Jason isn't simply performing his pain as he performed his amusement, playing the classic role of the tragic gay man. After all, he tells us early on that he's learned to hustle in many different ways. You see, beyond its astonishingly intimate look at one man, Clark's movie gets you thinking about essential issues that most nonfiction naively or cynically ignores. It raises profound questions about the nature of the self, about the relationship between fiction and reality, and about the way that film doesn't simply record raw truth, but shapes it into something reflecting the filmmaker's vision of life. Clark was hip to all this, which is why the movie is titled Portrait of Jason and not simply Jason. There's a world of difference between the two, and she knew it.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. Portrait of Jason is currently playing at the IFC Center in New York. It opens later this month in L.A., Chicago, and Philadelphia, and in other cities throughout the summer and fall. Coming up, criminologist Adrian Rain tells us about his new book, The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Research into the criminal mind took a different turn 20 years ago when brain imaging made it possible for researchers to study the brains of violent criminals. The first person to conduct a brain imaging study on murderers was our next guest, Adrian Raine. He's continued to study the brains of murderers and psychopaths, and this research has convinced Raine that irregularities in the brain and nervous system can contribute to a person becoming violent. He describes his research, as well as other related research in this new field of neurocriminology, in his new book, The Anatomy of Violence: The Biological Roots of Crime. The book has inspired a TV pilot co-created by Howard Gordon, executive producer of 24 and Homeland, with Raine, played by David Harewood, who played David Estes on Homeland. Adrian Raine is a professor of criminology, psychiatry, and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He spoke to Terry last Wednesday.
Adrian Raine, welcome to Fresh Air. So you were the first person to do brain imaging on convicted murderers. So I'm going to ask you first to just set the scene for us. Like the prisoners were brought in with shackles and chains to the MRI?
It was a PET scanner. My colleague here was Monty Buxbaum at UC Irvine. And yes, I mean, it looked quite dramatic when you were there watching it. The prisoner was brought there in shackles and chains with two guards and trooped through the facility. But you know what? The prisoners were very, very cooperative. You know, they were injected with a radioactive isotope. They had to do a sustained attention task for 30 minutes because that activates or challenges the prefrontal region of the brain, the part we thought may be dysfunctional in the murderers. Then they're put into the PET scanner and we're looking at the radioactivity coming from their brain. Basically, this fluorodeoxyglucose gets tagged to glucose. Now, when your brain's active, it's using glucose as its fuel. Wherever the glucose goes in the brain, so goes the radioactive isotope. And then in the scanner, by looking at the emission of that radioactivity, you can impute what brain areas are most active in that individual's brain.
So what did you learn from that?
Well, the key finding we got there was that murderers as a group, and you know, there was 41 murderers here, and then 41 matched controls. As a group, the murderers had much poorer functioning in the very frontal region of the brain. Now, why might that predispose someone to homicide? Well, the prefrontal cortex is very much involved in regulating and controlling behavior. You know, it checks on our impulses. We all get a bit impulsive at times. What stops us lashing out? It's a good functioning prefrontal cortex that says, wait a bit, now is not the time to lash out. And it's also the part of the brain that regulates and controls emotion. Now look, you'll know in your daily life, we all get angry at some point in time. What stops us, you know, going crazily berserk? It's that prefrontal cortex. It's like the guardian angel on behavior, you know?
So you scan the brains of 41 murderers, which, you know, it's a lot of people to brain scan, but it's not a really huge proportion of our murder population. So how typical do you think their scans are of the larger population of people who commit murder?
You know, this is a very important point because it's not one size fits all. I mean, you know, as a group, yes, the 41 murderers had poorer frontal lobe functioning, but they didn't all have poor frontal lobe functioning. In fact, when we divide our murderers up into those who plan and regulate their homicide versus those who are impulsive and emotional, it's the ones who were impulsive and emotional during the homicide, they were the ones with the poor frontal lobe functioning. Whereas in contrast, those that plan and regulate, they were quite normal there. I mean, take one of our murderers, Randy Kraft. He killed 64 people in a 12-year period, almost without getting caught. In fact, he was really unlucky to be caught. I mean, it was just a moving violation late one night on the freeway outside of Los Angeles. And he was pulled over. And, you know, the California Highway Patrol got a little bit suspicious when they found a dead body in the passenger seat. Mm. But, you know, moving violation. I mean, and serial killers actually tend to get caught by that. The license plate drops off. But take Randy's brain. He had excellent frontal lobe functioning. And he's the exception, I think, that proves the rule. Because here we have a man, you know, a computer consultant, smart guy. He could carefully plan and regulate those homicides, cleaning up the bodies, wiping away the clues, and then getting in to do a hard day's work on his computing work you know, without a care in the world. And you've got to have something good going for you to be able to do that. And what he had good going for him is that good frontal functioning, allowing him to plan and regulate and control his behavior.
So if you were able to scan other parts of his brain and do a kind of biological assessment of him, what do you think you would find that might explain his serial murders?
It's not the frontal cortex in his case. In people like him, what I suspect, and what others suspect too, is that there's a deeper part of the brain. It's called the amygdala. It's the seat of emotion. It generates emotions, you know, like fear, for example. Or it's involved in having empathy for people or having a conscience. When we brain scanned psychopathic individuals and compared them to match controls, we found that that amygdala part of the brain, it was reduced in volume by 18%. It was shrunken physically 18%. So if the emotion part of the brain is shrunken, that might well explain why psychopaths lack remorse, lack guilt, lack conscience, and why they don't really care about sticking a knife in you to get what they want.
So I want to talk a little more later about how the brain, neurochemistry, biology affect somebody's predisposition to crime. But let's just pause here for a second and talk about, in terms of murder and psychopathology, if you have a brain disposition to that, how should that be taken into account at your trial and how society decides to punish you?
The key question is this. Simply put, if bad brains do cause bad behavior, and if the causes of the brain dysfunction come relatively early in life, and that's what I argue for, there's a whole host of factors we can go into here. But if that's true, then should we fully hold that adult individual responsible when the root causes of its behavior came early in life, well beyond its control? Now, I've got to be careful here. There's no destiny here. Biology is not destiny, and it's more than biology, and there's lots of factors that we're talking about here. And one factor, like prefrontal dysfunction or low heart rate, doesn't make you a criminal offender. But what if all the boxes were checked? You know, what if you had birth complications and you were exposed to toxins and you had the gene that raises the odds of violence, etc., etc.? Stuff happening early on in life, and you're not responsible for that. Then how, in the name of justice, can we really hold that individual as responsible as we do and punish them as much as we do, including death? That's the question that neurocriminology, this emerging body of evidence, is posing for the judicial system, who are increasingly becoming interested in the interface between neuroscience and the law.
Well, even if the cause of the pathology is out of the person's control because it has a neurological root, they're still capable of terrible behavior, and you have to acknowledge that. So just tell us briefly, what are some of the alternatives that you see to just, you know, like death row or throwing them in prison for the rest of their lives and into prisons that are usually pretty violent too?
You know, I mean, at one level we can talk about treatment, but take that individual with all the boxes checked, all the risk factors, and their free will was constrained early in life, and they commit a murder. Then let's take you, who I presume you don't have too many risk factors in your life, and then you go and kill me. You commit the same act. You've got no excuses, the other person has. Don't we go easier on that other person, and instead of either executing them or taking away their basic rights, we put them more in a safe, secure institution where the regime is not as harsh and their basic human rights are not lost. I'm not saying let them back out on the street, because, as I say, there could be walking time bombs waiting to explode. But let's step back a little and recognize that, you know, okay, maybe we do have free will, but some people have more free will than others.
Well, you've also been the victim of crime.
Yep.
In fact, your new book, The Anatomy of Violence, basically opens with a burglar intruding into your bedroom at 3 in the morning in Turkey,
yes,
where you were at the time. And you write, you had always told your students, if there's an intruder in your home in the middle of the night, just pretend you're sleeping, because the vast majority of burglars who are home invaders, they want to get the goods and go. They don't really want to hurt you. But what you actually did, instead of taking your advice, was?
In one split second, I leapt out of the bed and grabbed him by the throat with my hand. I have no idea why I did that. I mean, looking back, it's an instinctive reaction from the amygdala, the fight-flight system. I had no idea what I was doing. And all I knew at that point is that, I mean, he was hitting me with everything he had. It felt like he had four fists because he was kicking me with his feet and hitting me with his hands. What I didn't know is that during the fight, because it was dark, 3 o'clock in the morning, that when he was hitting me hard, he had a knife in his hand. And when he hit me hard in the throat, hit me hard in the head, I saw white light, he threw me against the door. What, fortunately for me, occurred is that the blade of the knife snapped off early on in the fight. So when he stuck the knife into my throat, there was only 2 or 3 millimeters of metal left on the handle. So I lost my voice and I only needed 5 or 6 stitches in my throat.
So he slit your throat, but not much of it.
That's right. Exactly. And, you know, I managed to push him out of the window. And then I put the light on. I thought, this is, you know, I mean, you know, you're not thinking during the time. Actually, you're not really feeling anything either. You're not. You know, you're just going through the motions. Put the light on. I had this sense of relief. And then I saw this blood down my chest. Tried to shout out and there was nothing coming out of my voice. So they took me to the hospital to get stitched up. And I'll never forget, laid out on that slab in that Turkish hospital. There was a party going on somewhere. There was a record playing. It was the Beatles, "It's Been a Hard Day's Night." I'm not joshing you. That's really true. I wasn't making that up.
So what were some of the lessons you learned as a criminologist from being the victim?
Being a victim, it's not exactly a lesson, but it changed my perspective on the death penalty. I mean, at that point in time, I'd always been against the death penalty. I mean, I'm from England. We don't have the death penalty there. You know, you just think, you know, that's crazy having the death penalty. After being that victim, I changed my mind about that because it made me feel more about what victims experience and how maybe in some cases it could give them a sense of closure. Now, I would not be ruled out of the jury on a death penalty case, but I'm not proud of that. But I have to tell you, after what happened to me, I have that feeling inside me.
Wait a minute. This goes against everything you were saying earlier.
I know.
That, like, if say you did a brain scan of this criminal's brain, the one who could have killed you had his blade been longer, because he did try to slit your throat.
Yep.
Say you found that there was some deficiency structurally or anatomically in his brain that could have helped explain his inability to control his actions. Earlier you were saying that person probably shouldn't be killed. That person maybe shouldn't even been thrown into a violent prison. That person maybe should be put in a center that's controlled where they'll never get out again. But I don't know, have you reconciled the victim part of you with the criminologist part of you?
I'm a Jekyll and Hyde. So there's a Dr. Jekyll inside of me that's done the research, seen these risk factors, done longitudinal studies, documented these early risk factors beyond the individual's control that moves them into a criminal way of life. And that Dr. Jekyll is saying, you know, you can't ignore this. You can't turn a blind eye to the biology of violence and the social factors too. But there's a Mr. Hyde inside of me ranting and raving and saying, look, I don't want sob stories. I don't want excuses. There's a cause for all behavior. We can always find a cause for behavior. It comes from the brain. So what? You know, we found the cause. Okay, great. You know, what about the victim? What about how they feel? And what about that sense of retribution? You know, what about deterrence? So, yeah, I mean, I go backwards and forwards on this. And, you know, I bet I'll change my mind again at some point in time.
But I thought you'd made the argument earlier that for some criminals, deterrence wouldn't really be effective because they have no feelings of guilt.
They don't have
an emotional center and they don't have any fear.
Yep.
So how would deterrence prevent anything?
The scientist inside of me says, you know, that deterrence aspect, especially to capital punishment, you know, that's not working. And I don't think the science really shows it too. But How can I say it? I mean, there's part of me that says, you know, it's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and a pound of flesh. That, you know, there has to be accountability here. My throat was slit. His throat should be slit, you know? I mean, that's just how you feel as a victim. Again, I'm not proud of this. I'm not proud to say that. But it's the truth, you know? You know, kids need to be socialized and punished for bad behavior. And doesn't that also apply in you know, for us adults, you know? You know, if you buy in to the arguments that Dr. Jekyll inside of me says, you know, then all bets are off. Nobody's responsible. You can't have that.
So what I think I'm hearing you say is that even you, who's at the forefront of the brain scanning of criminals to try to understand how brain dysfunction affects somebody's criminal direction, even you maybe aren't really sure how we should be using this yet. You're not really sure. What does it mean? How do we apply it?
I know. As an academic, part of me is arguing we need the concept of partial responsibility. Stephen Morse has argued this before, partial responsibility. So in the guilt phase, not just innocent or guilt, but partial responsibility, you know, so that it's, you know, taking into account things like this. I think in part we need to change the law at one level. I think we need to take these, you know, mitigating factors far more into account in the penalty phase of a trial than we're doing at the moment. I mean, that's true. I believe that. I do believe that. One side of me believes that. But another part of me says, but you know, again, where goes responsibility? I'm worried about that. Free will. You know, are we going to lose our concept of free will, agency? Does it mean that we don't have control? That, to me, is a slippery slope, a dangerous slippery slope to Armageddon.
Well, Adrian Raine, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Adrian Raine spoke with Terry Gross last Wednesday. He's the author of the new book, The Anatomy of Violence. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by something other than panic and dread. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shah. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.